the afternoon, and particularly slow moving, bringing a risk of some torrential localised downpours that again poses the threat of some localised flooding, just like we've seen in places over the last few days. So some potentially pretty nasty storms around for both Northern Ireland and Scotland, but dodge the storms and your temperatures will climb to around about 21 or 22 degrees Celsius. That's the latest weather. Back to you, Luke.
Chris, thank you. Now on Radio 4, we continue our journey through the year, and there are sensations in Paris and Vienna in our Book of the Week, 1913, by Florian Illies, a snapshot of Europe on the verge of war, using biographical extracts and contemporary stories.
After the publication of the first volume of Proust's In Search of Lost Time, Anatole France writes, "Life is too short, and Proust, too long." Too long even before the remaining six volumes had come out. In May, Die Brücke dissolves once and for all. The chronicle of the group, written by Ernst Ludwig Kirchner, provokes the other members. Kirchner depicts himself as the leading figure in the group, the inventor of the expressionist woodcut and expressionist sculpture, and generally speaking, the guiding spirit of the movement. For the first page of the Chronicle, Kirchner has made a woodcut featuring portraits of the members. He had surrounded his own head on the top left with a little halo. May in Paris. Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées. At the post-rehearsal party at the Leroux restaurant with Nijinsky, Maurice Ravel, André Gide, Diaghilev and Stravinsky, the general view was that the premiere tomorrow evening would cause a scandal. The audience is the most cultivated in old Europe. Sitting in one of the boxes is Gabriele D'Annunzio. In another is Claude Debussy. Coco Chanel is in the auditorium, and so is Marcel Duchamp. For the rest of his life, Duchamp will say later he would never forget the shouting and screeching of that evening. From the first note of the extremely high solo bassoon, roars of laughter can be heard. Is that music, or a spring storm, or the noise of hell, the outraged audience wants to know. Drumming everywhere, up on stage, the dancers are in ecstatic motion. There's laughter, then, when the Parisians realize it is meant seriously, shouting. The devotees of the modern, on the other hand, applaud from the cheap seats. The music rages on, and the dancers get tangled up. They can no longer hear the music for all the noise. From somewhere or other, Ravel is shouting, "Genius!" into the auditorium. On May the 25th, Vienna is frozen with shock. One of the most senior military officers and secret service personnel in the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, Colonel Alfred Redl, has been accused of espionage and has shot himself in his hotel room at 1:45 in the morning. The pistol had been placed in his room, room 1 at the Hotel Klompser, where he always stayed, in return for his signature on the paper in which he confessed his guilt. Redl asked the Secret Service staff to leave the room quietly before pulling the trigger. An announcement is placed in the newspapers which tries to maintain appearances. The General Chief of Staff of the Prague Army Corps, Colonel Alfred Redl, has taken his own life in an attack of mental confusion. The talented officer, who had a great career ahead of him, had been suffering from insomnia for some time. One of the most influential officers in Austro-Hungary had betrayed all the state's military plans to the enemy, and they tried to package it as suicide caused by insomnia. But Vienna hadn't reckoned with Egon Erwin Kisch, a young reporter with the newspaper Bohemia. That Sunday, Kish had been at a football match to interview the Sturm player Hans Wagner, but Wagner, who also works as a fitter, does not turn up. On the Monday, Wagner explains his non-arrival, and Kish learns that the previous morning the fitter had been recruited by the military to break into a private apartment in the Army Corps headquarters. He had seen strange things there. Ladies' tulle dresses, perfumed draperies, and pink silk sheets. Kish places an article in a Berlin newspaper about the true background to the death of Colonel Radl. By Thursday, the 29th of May, the War Ministry's military review has to reveal the whole truth. Colonel Radl, ironically awarded the Order of the Iron Crown Third Class for his services to counter-espionage, who reported to the Kaiser in person, this Colonel Radl was suddenly exposed as a character out of an operetta. The small, dapper, red-haired man had spent his entire fortune on his homosexual lovers, giving them cars and flats and buying himself perfumes and hair dyes. Having found himself in financial difficulties, he had been selling off all Austria-Hungary's deployment plans, military codes, and projects for national expansion. Now, it was meltdown. The name Radl became synonymous with a system that had gone rotten. But the Radl affair turns Egon Erwin Kish, the man who uncovered it, into a legendary reporter. In return, he receives one of the highest civilian decorations that Vienna has to offer. The best table in Café Central is always reserved for him. On the eve of the Radl affair, Berlin is preparing itself for the greatest social event of the young century, the wedding of Princess Victoria Louise of Prussia to Duke Ernst August of Hanover. The bridal couple drive along Unter den Linden, where thousands are cheering. Both Tsar Nicholas II and King George V travel to Berlin and Potsdam for the wedding, as do countless crowned and uncrowned heads from all over Europe. Only Franz Ferdinand, the successor to the Austrian throne, was not invited. Even in Vienna, he'd long been shunned because of his unsuitable bride. But this public humiliation on a European stage is a fresh blow for him. All the others celebrate until the small hours, but then, before breakfast, the kings and czars are given the news from Vienna by their intelligence services about Colonel Radl. But the czar gives no sign that he has lost his most important informer. He cuts the top off his boiled egg and chats. Decorum is maintained. On the 8th June in Prague, Kafka finally begins to ask for Felice's hand in marriage, but he breaks off mid-sentence, and it's not until 8 days later that he is able to bring himself to finish the letter. It ends up being over 20 pages long. Kafka begins with a detailed account of how he needs to look for a doctor, what exactly he wants him to certify, perhaps fertility or sanity, is unclear. He continues, "Now, bear in mind, Phyllis, that in the face of this uncertainty, it is hard to say the words, and it must sound peculiar. It's simply too soon to say it, but afterwards it will be too late, and then there won't be any time for discussing such things as you mentioned in your last letter, but there isn't any time to hesitate for too long. At least, that's how I feel about it, so that's why I'm asking. In view of the above premise, which is sadly ineradicable, do you want to consider whether you want to become my wife? Do you want that?" Then he presents Phyllis with the cost-benefit calculation of a potential marriage. "Now, give some thought, Phyllis, to how marriage would change us, what each of us would gain and lose. I would lose my, for the most part, terrible solitude, and gain you, whom I love more than anyone else in the world. But you would lose your former life, with which you are almost entirely content. You would lose Berlin, the office you love, your friends, little pleasures, the prospect of marrying a healthy, cheerful, good man, and of having beautiful, healthy children, which you, if you stop to think about it, really long for. And on top of this inestimable loss, you would gain a sick, weak, unsociable, taciturn, sad, stiff, pretty much hopeless human being. Kafka is still uneasy, for he suspects he has stuck his neck out on this occasion, even though he tried to cover up and mask his question, but he knows that somewhere in the middle of the letter, he did ask her to marry him. He hums and haws before putting the letter in an envelope, then goes on a laborious search for a bigger envelope because the letter is now so thick. Then he goes out onto the street, but dawdles, waiting so long that all of the post offices have closed for the evening. Then he is suddenly overwhelmed by the desire for Phyllis to have the letter on her desk first thing in the morning, so he runs to the station where urgent posts can be put on the fast train to Berlin. On the 8th of June, the German stadium, built for the 1916 Olympic Games, which are due to be held in Berlin, is officially opened by Kaiser Wilhelm II. The builders completed it 3 years ahead of schedule. On the 20th of June, at midday, the unemployed 30-year-old teacher Ernst Friedrich Schmidt from Bad Sulze walks into the St. Marian School in Bremen draped with weapons. Brandishing at least 6 loaded revolvers, he forces his way into the classrooms on a shooting rampage. When one revolver runs out of bullets, he reaches for the next. 5 girls between the ages of 7 and 8 die, while 18 children and 5 adults are severely injured. Eventually, a passerby manages to overpower him. He later claims he was protesting about not having found a teaching position. On the 10th of July, the highest temperature ever recorded is measured in Death Valley, 56.7 degrees Celsius. It rains in Germany. It's barely 11 degrees. In The Hague, the Palace of Freedom is inaugurated in September, built with the help of donations from all over the world, including around 1.25 million from the American multimillionaire Andrew Carnegie. Preparations begin for a new Hague peace conference to be held in 1915, which is intended to resolve all unresolved issues between nations. There are over 200 cinemas in Berlin by 1913. The pedagogue Adolf Selman writes in the foreword to his book Cinema and School that legal measures and police regulations should be passed so that our young people are granted protection against all the corrupting influences that the cinema can exert. The Mona Lisa is still nowhere to be found. In the Louvre, a painting by Corot has been hung on the orphaned nail.
"1913, The Year Before the Storm" was written by Florian Illies, abridged by Pete Nichols and read by Michael Maloney. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4, where the shipping forecast follows sailing by. Thank you. And now on Radio 4, time for the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on today, Friday the 26th of July. The general synopsis at 1800, low 150 miles west of Shannon, 1002, expected 100 miles west of northwest Fitzroy, 1000, by 1800 on Friday. New low expected just west of Rockall, 1007.